Well, I'm going to get us started so we can get finished. I'm Bob Wiley, and we're going to be talking about change this particular session. But before we do, I want to hold up some resources and things that I feel, books that are real good. Lyle Schaller probably is responsible for most of our material. He seems to be the one that does more writing. There's a bibliography prepared by the Southeastern faculty that someone was responsible for putting together. One of the books on there is this book, The Small Church Is Different. It's a new publication this year, been out about 3 months. Typical Schaller style, very readable, very organized. You will find that find it helpful. I think that his major philosophy in this is comparing the small church as over against the larger church, and in doing so, you get the small church is like this because it's not like that, rather than the small church is like this, period. But it's good. Another of his books, much older, is Change Agent. Anytime you're dealing with change, this is a handbook. You can see I have used it quite a bit. It's a 1972 publication. Deals with change, the nature of change, the process of plan change, change agentry, the use of power, social change, etc. Then in the creative leadership series that he produces, you have Leading Churches Through Change, Douglas Walrath. Walrath has taken several churches and made case studies of how they went through change, reacted to change, some of the problems encountered, this kind of thing. I think it works good in group discussions kinds of thing, anytime you're dealing with case studies. And then Assimilating New Members. This is what, about a 3-year-old book, 4-year book. It deals with change in the sense of how do churches change so that as people join, they feel a part of the congregation. And he has some interesting things to say in here. You know, where the church is a large circle, and then there's an inner circle inside that. That is the fellowship or the controlling part of the church. Where do you find yourself? The fact that a healthy church is made up of many small groups that are open to new folks. There are no closed circles in that diagram. But he deals with change in that respect.
Who's the author of that, Schaller?
Schaller. All four of those Schaller is responsible for. Then Southern Baptist, this is Treadwell and McSwain, Broadman Press, Conflict Ministry in the Church. It's an excellent gathering up of the materials and throws in some new ideas on conflict. I'll be using part of this tomorrow and Thursday, especially on the part where it talks about the church as contributing to stress. I don't know where the idea came from for his. I got it from a study of stress. And I found that that's probably as much a truth as anything, the fact that churches create stress for members. And very often pastors are the greatest stressor in the church, when you stop and think about stress as a result of change, and change as it is occurring. But it's an excellent book. Another one is by Dan Bagby. The name of it just went right through. It's also available. It's a Broadman Press book, but it's on stress in the church. I tell you, it just went by me real quick then. But Dan Bagby's a personal friend. And it's a good book on stress.
Before you leave here, you might want to get a publication that one of our professors put out, Ecclesiological Neurosis in the Church.
Oh, okay.
Who?
Cumby?
Dr. Cumby.
And it's on stress as well?
Right.
Okay.
Stress caused by the Church.
Okay, good. This is not a church publication. This is a book I picked up. It's actually a book on community action, how to get community action done. But it has a very simplistic language style for communicating some of the same things that you'll find in these books, but it's written more in a layman's language, I believe. And it's very good. This is a book by Interpersonal Communication Programs, Inc. I have no idea where I bought it. I was either in an airport bookstore or some one of these other bookstores in some town, and I saw it and I bought it. But I think it's a real good book. It can be ordered. I'm sure it's not out of print if you want the information on it. The title is Making Change by Eileen Guthrie and Warren Miller. Now, we will be dealing only with the process of change in this section. Tomorrow we'll deal with a resultant effect of change, conflict. And Thursday we'll be dealing with a process for managing change. Now all of them interrelate, and it's hard not to overlap. I don't know if all of you were available for all that's occurred this afternoon, but am I in your way? Can you see? Okay, good. These are factors. Oh, I want to hold up one other book. Forget it. This is one that we just finished publishing at the Home Mission Board. We had a symposium on change at Atlanta back in February, and this is the publication of all those facts. It's about 135 pages long, but it deals with various aspects of change, SBC involvement in change, some of the expectations and dynamics as affecting Southern Baptist life. But it is basic piece on change as it relates to churches. I have other copies of this. They're $4.95 if you're interested. No skin off my back if you're not. Okay. This could be read as rural or village, and these characteristics used to be very strong one way or the other. You could tell the country boy from the city slicker real quick. There were a lot of characteristics that seemed to just jump out. And for example, the way you would talk would be some way to pick that out. The way you used to dress. But nowadays, see, everybody wears jeans anywhere, and they're acceptable dress, even formal wear if you wear the right kind of coat with them. It used to be that you could tell the farmer because he drove a pickup truck, but everybody drives pickup trucks now. And worldview used to be considered different. The residents of rural areas had a very small concept of what the world was like. It was provincial. It was narrow, whereas city people were so much more cosmopolitan in their thinking, this kind of thing. But that's changed today. The differences are not so great in many, many respects. The rates of social change used to be that you could just easily talk about rural areas as being very slow in changing. And in the city, the clock and the amount of change and the degrees of change that you could bring about determined how successful you were. Back in the 60s, what was it they talked about in building into cars and appliances that you'd buy for your house? What did they call that?
Planned obsolescence.
Because it was a matter of change. And newer is better. And old is just not very good. It can't be. But those kinds of things have diminished in the rural areas. The farmer had to do it all. He was a mechanic. He was a carpenter. He was a farmer. Just about anything that needed to be done, he did it. Today, with so few people living on farms in rural areas, everybody out there, like I live in a rural area, but I don't live on a farm. I'm out in the county, away from Atlanta. I work on my car to a degree, but it scares me to death when I have to take my car to somebody that I don't know. So I get an estimate written down, and I'm acting like a good city person, see? I have him write it down, and if he's going to do different than what's written on that estimate, I want him to call me. Because I don't trust him. That's really the truth. I don't trust him. Whereas when I was a teenager, I remember my dad and I had an old 49 Mercury. We took that car to a guy and I said, it won't work. He said, what's wrong with it? I said, I don't know. I brought it to you so you'd find out. I'll pick it up when? He said, I'll call you when it's finished. Didn't worry about it. And that used to be true in rural areas is over against city areas. The kinds of relationships were contractual in the city where they're more open-ended, generalist, out in the rural areas. The relationships. A very large, extended family kind of relationship in rural areas. That's still true to a large degree, although it's changing as well. Where in the city, you were a member of a club, or you were anonymous other than just by a small group of people. Even the people that you work with in the city, you don't get too close to them. Organized groups, rural areas, people weren't members of many groups. Didn't have any need for them. Along about the 20s, with changing political emphasis, and the rise in industrialism, I believe, the farmers had to begin to build their cooperatives, and then they had to get their voice heard in the national legislature. So they began to group themselves more into that area, but then FFA and FHA, is that the girls? FFA, that's the boys, Future Farmers. Future Homemakers? Yeah, it's FHA. And then there was an opening up to other groups. I think the breaking down of the school systems created larger need in rural areas for groups. The changing postal system. So many things to where there are organized groups now in rural areas, maybe not to the extent that there are in cities, but nevertheless, they're there. Time. In the rural areas, it was always of little value. But TV's changed that. I mean, it used to be that out in the country church, they didn't worry about getting through in a morning worship. But now, they're ready to quit at 11:30 if you started at 10:30. An hour's long enough. Because we've gotten ourselves geared up to time. But nevertheless, time is still a low value to most rural people, I think, because it's a people time, not built around clocks and calendars and like we find in cities. But it's changing. The values and the people. And I have another cell I want to deal with on that. All of this seems to point out change, but there's an interesting thing about it. We see that change is occurring in the rural political system, the school system, the tax structure, the way that land is used, the way that farmers farm. Well, on and on. We could talk about the kinds of changes that are occurring. But there's one institution that's not being affected greatly by change. And I've bounced this off of different sociologists every time I get a chance. And I talk at it like, about the issue like this. I say, is it not true that it's difficult today to find a true rural area today in our world? They say, yeah, it's really difficult to find a truly rural community. I say, what about the church? No, it's not hard to find rural churches at all, because everything has changed but the church. Rural people say, you can change my government. You can change my school. You can change the way I have to farm. But you're not going to change the way I do church. And have you thought about that? Have you realized that in your own realization as you work with people? What do you think the difference is? Why will they allow some things to change but churches don't change?
That's one of the only things that they really have control
of. Okay, they have control of it. That's the strongest, most obvious thing that jumps up. What else?
They are based on tradition.
And tradition... And that speaks to somewhat the way they do business. Hopefully, tradition is built on meaning. Hopefully, tradition is built on something that speaks to their values and to the way they have developed their belief system and to the way they have interpreted biblical understanding. Hopefully, those things are correct, but it's not always true. I think that change is difficult emotionally, and it is a last bulwark for them, if you please, of security in a world that has been disrupted by massive amounts of change. One person earlier this morning said, when you stop and think about the number of older people in my church and the fact that many of them were reared as children in a horse and buggy generation, and now they can watch a man on the moon. They can go to Florida and see rockets take off. Or they've watched great other communications kinds of changes take place. Seems like there's only so much change that I can handle and cope with. And so they build up the barrier to change on those things they can control. I know the older I get, the less open I am to change. It's not because I don't want to change. It's because I know what works best for me. You know, I'm comfortable with it. So why try to get me to do something that I'll have to relearn and do skills all over with? If I want to grow, let me do some changes in some areas that I'm wanting to change in. Let me improve my golf score. But don't make me change in some area that I'm already comfortable in, secure in. I think that speaks to it to a large degree. But these are some values that have really dominated rural church life. And they have impact today. And when you as a worker going to a rural church, you bump up against these things. The sanctity of traditional family life. Now see, that doesn't affect just the way people live. That's also the woman issue in the church. Because anytime you begin to challenge male dominance in traditional family lifestyle and its structure, see, that's a woman taking leadership. And you're challenging this when you start talking about that. Divorce as an issue. The 1980 census has shown time and time again, as you look at it, on the characteristics involved in the 80s, that people as they divorce move out of rural areas into urban areas where there's a little bit more, where they can be lost in the crowd, where people don't point their finger and say, uh-huh, and people feel like they're whispering behind their back because they're divorced. But I dare say even some of those things will be changed. But it is a value that's strong in rural churches. There's a low risk, non-change. That's a high value among rural people. I don't know why. I only know it's true. I run into this kind of thing every once in a while. I'll be in a church and there'll be a farmer there arguing over $25 or $30 item in the church. But that same farmer will mortgage his farm and buy a tractor. You don't explain that. It's just that it has the idea of low risk. It's not non-change necessarily. It's little change. They will change. Individualism, in the sense of rugged individualism, strength of character, being what you are capable of being, lifting up the worth of the individual as a person. I think that's a strong rural character. It's carried over from frontier days, and it still impacts that concept of strength of the person.
Is there any reason why that's a small church value, that small rural churches often come off so strongly on the racial issue?
Well, it challenges tradition. See, the racial issue is not individuals, it's fear of loss of family strength. That's just one piece of it. I think it's a multidimensional factor that can't be understood. But I think they fear loss of traditional lifestyle. Which is a part of it, see. And they don't want their young'uns growing up and falling in love with someone of another race. And they would be abhorred at the idea of a Caucasian, what they are, falling in love with any other race, not just black. But I think it's because of tradition as a lifestyle. Local autonomy and parochialism, those sound so negative, but they don't. They really aren't intended to be negative. They're value in the sense that we're capable, and we don't trust outsiders because they don't know us, they don't understand us, and they'll lead us down the wrong way. This is why directors of missions and the associations sometimes have a hard time working with some rural churches because they're outsiders, or state conventions coming in. Seminary professor may be highly regarded here on campus, but he can take his doctor's degree to a small church and they could care less. You know, it just doesn't make any difference. They don't accept him. They don't trust him just because. And this is true of government, of so many outside forces. And loyalty to a group. And this is very strong at this point. Schaller, Dudley, so many say, this loyalty is so strong that it's almost impossible to kill a small church. Try to merge two of them that don't want to be. I mean, there may not be more than 15 people involved, but try to merge them, and you'll find how strong they are. You want to add anything to this? Now these, though these are not extreme differences today, in a cultural setting, as rural as over against urban, they're becoming more and more alike. However, in the church, those are very strong. Though they may not operate like that in business life at all. And that's hard to cope with. You take a leading businessman in a small town, get him out in that rural church, and he becomes another person concerning the church. Now, the exact opposite can be found to any of this. These are not hard and fast rules. In the book, Change in Big Town, Small City, a man who has been one of the formative sociologists is quoted by these seven listings as things that indicate cultural and social change. And these are the kinds of things that happen as we go through change in life in America. More red tape develops. The mass of people gets closer and closer. Values begin to erode or take on a different perspective, according to which way you're looking. The divisions of labor develop. Relationships change. More groups appear. Weight Watchers is what this is talking about. Rotary clubs, that kind of thing. And the transfer of functions, where people pass off those things that we could do for ourselves, now we let others do them for us. And government-wise, that's important. In agribusiness, we see this kind of thing taking place. Instead of the farmer worrying about how he is going to get all of his fields fertilized, now all he has to do is call up a company and they'll take care of coming in and spraying the fields. Or he can join with others and they'll even come in and harvest the crops. And so we have a lot of absentee farmers today. They own the land. They are, quote, doing the farming, but actually it's being done by some other company doing it for them. But these are massive changes that occur throughout total society today that are affecting all of us. When we talk about change as it relates to us, these three dimensions affect the church. And I'm going to get more and more specific as we go here. When we talk about the magnitude of change, we're talking about how much change are you trying to get done. In the late 1960s to the 1970s, in a three-year period, it was actually a two-year period where I remember the emphasis being real strong, Southern Baptists moved from a six-point system to an eight-point system, moved from one basic literature to a multiplicity of available literature for your Sunday schools. They changed from a methodology of teaching that they had been teaching for 30 or 40 years, just improving on how to get it communicated and how to train the workers and how to get them to use the materials. But for 30 or 40 years, they had been very successful in the church study course, in the state level meetings, in the use of material, and in raising up Sunday school workers. But all of a sudden in 1970, they just opened the door and pitched all of that out and dumped everything new in. Now, how long has it been since all of us have been in a church where you still see on the door primary, junior, and intermediate? Now, I go in them all over the country yet today, where those are pre-1970 terms. But those churches have refused to change. The name was Training Union, Baptist Training Union, BTU. And they tried to put on us another name. Y'all remember what it was? Quest. In 1970, they tried to throw the name Quest in for church training. Church training is a result of the name change. They just reversed them. But Southern Baptist on the floor of the convention, isn't it true, where they said, no way, we're not going to accept that name. What I think it was a statement saying, we've had all the change we can stand. We've had as much change as we can possibly take hold of right now. And it's going to take us a long time. What's the quote? How long does it take for information on the SBC level to filter down to the grassroots? 7 years? 8 years? Bold Mission Thrust is just now beginning to get out into our churches. But I still am in churches that know nothing about Bold Mission Thrust. Never even heard the term, let alone be a part of it. The magnitude of change is important. And this, in a rural church, if you're going in, you need to be weighing out how much change am I expecting them to grasp? And in what time period am I expecting change to occur? Now see, you live on a different time frame as a rural pastor than the people who have lived there. I look at you and you're young fellas. I'm a young fella, you know. And I go in and I say, man, I don't have long. I got to have it done now. And they say, well, you can do it somewhere else. you have to adopt a new time frame to get things done. And it's according to who is involved somewhat that affects this as well. The effect on the system, not just the church, but the systems in that community are affected, and that will determine how successful you can be. Now, I didn't know it, but I disrupted a whole community. And I had people mad at me in the town where my first pastorate was. I went in and told them, I'll be your pastor if you'll go to full-time services. Because I like to preach, I told them. You know, besides, you're not really a church, are you? Unless you're meeting Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. They said, well, if that's what you want, that's what you got. And I got hostile reactions. People, see, I didn't think about it, but people were married and had for years gone to each of their churches. They had married a husband, a member of one church, and a wife, a member of the other. And there were three major churches, the Baptist, the Methodist, Christian Church. And I just disrupted that whole thing. People no longer could go to church together on a regular basis because they had it outlined where, although my church only was a halftime church, they had full time. Every Sunday they could go to church and Sunday school. But I disrupted that. And I didn't have any sense, didn't have any care, really, that this changed things. But it affected my relationship in the community. It took me about 8 or 9 months to get over that problem. And even when I'd been there 2 years, I still ran into people saying, yeah, I remember what you did to us. And they'd bring that back up, although the church had prospered. But what effect are you going to have on the systems? If you live in that community for the first time, and they've always had a bivocational pastor who lived somewhere else and just came in for services or visitation, you need to check that out. See, because you're going to be a threat to somebody, most likely. A new person, maybe another pastor there who's had the domain all by himself. But, or the chairman of the deacons has run the church because you haven't lived there. Now that the pastor has moved on the field, it throws everything into a different way. What are the dimensions of change that you're trying to bring about? They're important. I think I'll save those two, looking at my time. As we talk about change, Kurt Lewin, back in 1925, somewhere in that area, defined change as an unfreezing, making the change, and refreezing of the process. It's a process whereby the change agent thaws the situation out, makes the change, and then there is a formalizing, refreezing step after the change has been made so that you don't slip back into the other way of doing things. Now, this particular pattern up here shows what happens too often. The people will allow the pastor to make a change. That's what this is. Now what they did, they said, we'll do that. You're not going to be here long. And when he leaves, they put it back where it was. Or he may have the resistance compressed. And when he makes a mistake that is opened up and they exert their energy again, and the pastor is changed, literally, to another church. There are several steps that go into this unfreezing process to bring about that kind of thing. There's an entry point. And it's important for us to talk a little bit about this one. When you go into a rural church and they're comfortable doing things like they are, and most of the people are older, why do you want to change things? Why should things be changed? Where did you learn that things ought to be changed? And how do you know that what you've got is better than what they've got? How do you know that what you want to do is really the thing that needs to be done? We just automatically assume that they're tradition-bound, cultural-bound, and we get ourselves in problems right away. The most typical thing that I see happening in churches like this, as a director of missions, I ran into it several times. It's interesting to observe a young man would go out to a church, and he was right. They weren't winning people. They weren't visiting. They weren't growing, and the opportunity was there. So after about 3 or 4 months of why you ought to be out there winning souls, he begins to think maybe the reason they're not winning people is they're not Christians. And his preaching then begins to take on a negative aspect as against them. And pretty soon that isn't working because none of them are walking the aisle. He begins to become a little bit more inflammatory and directive in his preaching. And pretty soon he proclaims the will of God and sets his foot down. And then I get a phone call. He says, "It's been God's will that I leave the church." Frustration sets in. It's difficult. At the point of entering a church, what is it that you look for and you must traverse with the people? What kind of change do you anticipate that needs to be made? What kind of assumptions do you work from? Well, we shouldn't have any assumptions about the people. Number one, we should go in and walk with them and live with them and try to find out where they are. In other words, we shouldn't try to change them for a while. Now, it's very obvious that if they're giving is adequate. And I don't know too many rural churches that don't have enough money to do what they want to do with. But that's not biblical stewardship necessarily. And it may not include missions properly. And their understanding of the kingdom of God may be narrow. And you may need to enlarge that. And it may be that they're not aware of unchurched people in the community. But you don't go in and assume that because they haven't baptized but 3 people in the last 2 years that they're dead. Because most rural churches that I run into are more open to other denominational kinds of people of other denominations than city churches. They tend to be more liberal, if you please, in their biblical understanding of things than city churches, because they have dialogue with people from other denominations more. I find that they are open to ministry a lot more than we think they are, and they're involved in mission care more than we are aware of, but it's not put into program structures. And so we don't see it, and we don't know how to count it. We don't see how they care for the extended family. So-and-so's sick. They don't care whether they're a church member or not. They just care for them, and they take care of them. And they may never tell you, as pastor, what's been done. It's just an automatic. They do it. They care for one another. So your assumptions need to be at almost a zero point, other than they are a people of God who need a pastor who will come and love them and walk with them and find out what their needs are, minister to those needs, and on Sunday morning stand up and preach what he learned about God this week. Because they need that worship experience. Now, if you're like I am, and I would assume that we're all very similar as ministers, within a short period of time, you'll find that there are some things that need to be changed. There are some major things that ought to be changed, but there are some little things that can be changed without too much trouble. One of those things that might be a major problem would be to move the piano from one side to the other, or to get the old piano replaced. That might be major, you know. Or to change the names of the departments, or to move people around in the building. Those are major things, because it's that understanding of space, like Quentin has talked about. But one of the first things that I would suggest in understanding this idea of entry is to simply take your time to walk with the people and to go with them. And as a part of that, you do a little bit of exploration in walking with them in this unfreezing stage of change. In that, you come to the realization that change does not occur without some pain. And if you've had any counseling classes at all, and you understand the grief cycle, people that go through change carry that grief cycle as a part of their change. And it is occurring in this area. It's that unfreezing that takes place for them. And don't be hard on them when they don't change quickly enough. I don't know how long unfreezing lasts. It's according to the magnitude. It's according to what it is that you're going to change and the effect on the system that it's going to change. This is the most critical part of change. And you need to deal with it at length. When you make the change, this is that where you say the change has been made. It may be the building that needs to be built. It may be replacing the piano, maybe replacing the hymnals, or remodeling the sanctuary, any number of things. But at what point is the change made? Is it when you vote to do it?
When it's accepted.
When it's accepted. And sometimes that's after it's done. Okay. But nevertheless, there was an initial point where the majority said that the change has been made. I like to think that it occurs, like if you're going to do a building, it occurs on groundbreaking day, not in the vote. It begins to occur for a fact when that spade is put in the ground and the soil is turned. It may not be formalized and refrozen until the mortgage is burned. And people would carry their distaste until that point. I knew one man, though, I was in the church, where he was against the new piano because his daughter was not the pianist, would not be the pianist, because she wasn't good enough to be the pianist. But he was against the new piano. And he was against the new piano as long as he lived, even though the church had bought it, paid for it, and it was set. People do carry these kinds of things, and there's not always a formal ending to it. But the church takes a formal stance when they vote on it, when you have a dedication service, when you have that formal time where the church makes a commitment as a body to what has been accomplished through this change. Most good processes will have a celebration point at the end that formalizes the end of that process. And it eases you up. It frees the church up to move on to other things. One or two other things, and I'll deal with this more in depth at another time. But in this unfreezing process to change, it's so easy to think that you've done everything that's possible and then to make the change because you've got the votes to do it. Voting doesn't mean you've done anything except you've outweighed the opposition. Most of us try to bring change. Here would be the status quo. And generally, there are forces on both sides, those that are for, those that are against. Most of us operate to bring change by overpowering from our point of view. We do that by disarming the other side. We try to cut them down. We try to take away their weapons. We try to outthink them. We try to discredit them. We move from issues to personalities. And in the long run, we just simply try to run over them. I had a pastor to tell me when I was early in my ministry and I was having some trouble. I said, what about the fact that I've done so much to try to bring these people along? He said, well, the truth is sometimes you have to plow out around the old stumps. And he's right. There are some times when you just have to disregard those who are against you and go on. But I was appalled that I was in a small church conference where they were holding up a good model, where the pastor had lined up the energy and just run over the opposition. And that was supposed to be a good model. And it really, really bothered me. Now, Speed Lees, who is with the Auburn Institute, has written a book on change. He talks about something that just really shocked me at first. And then I came to realize that that's probably the best, least volatile way of doing it. He says, generally, when people are opposed to change, it's because they have fear of what the change is going to bring. The way to bring them into the process is to not disarm them, but empower them. Give them some strength where they don't feel threatened. Let them know that they're part of it. And you're not against them. Bring them into the process to help bring that change about. Now, that's sometimes difficult to do because we get threatened by that change when we can't control what the change is going to be. But if change is the thing that you're after, in the light of how the people want that change to occur, you've got to bring people into it. Okay, now we've talked about the kinds of change, the dimensions of change, the change as a process here. I have one other thought that I want to deal with. And I'm holding you over. But it's simply this. Unless you have new people coming in. Unless you have new people coming in, you don't have a great deal to change. You have not got many reasons to bring about great change. And too often, pastors want to go in and change programs in a church. Programs should not be changed just to have new programs. But programs and structures of churches ought to reflect what that church is all about. And generally, when you get there, it is. And if there are no new people coming into a church, and you can't get them to see new people, or to incorporate new people in ministry, you have very little structural change to bring about in the church. Am I right or am I wrong? Well, our most obvious change, though, that we try to bring about is structural change. And that's where we get ourselves in trouble quicker than any other place. What needs to be done is to deal with people changes and then let the structural changes come from behind them and out of them. Any other comments? Questions? Let me call your attention. Everything on that table is not free. The church, our church on mission is free. This was a cost item, $4.95. And I want you to take those pads, our membership questionnaires. There's 100 to a pad. If you do the Our Church on Mission campaign, you need those. They fit in on it. That's $3 worth of free material there. But be sure to take what you need on those.